Hi there. Welcome to The Preventable, the podcast giving you a seat at the table with conversations about the intersection of alcohol, drugs, and mental health in everyday lives. Take a seat and join us. Welcome to The Preventable. With me today is a kind of an old friend of the agency. One of my peers represents an amazing organization that I don't know if you know this, but I'm a super fan of the organization. I'll nerd out in a second here. But and a distinguished recipient of this year's Howard Potratz Alumni Award. So Beth Elders is with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. Truly an honor to be back with colleagues and friends with you all. Yes.
And so your official title is Executive Director?
Correct. Executive Director, American Red Cross of Greater St. Louis.
Okay. So I got so much to talk to you about.
Bring it on.
So we were on a call right after I think you had kind of stepped into the role as executive director.
About 3 years ago.
Yes. Yeah. And you messaged me on Zoom and you're like, I went to Teen Institute. Mm-hmm. And I love hearing that. Our staff love hearing that. I mean, I've worked at the organization for 16 years and it brings me honest to goodness, like sheer joy when I meet people who went through our programs. And we have staff now who have been through our programs who are, you know, on our team.
Love it.
And it's just like, it's like the Lion King circle of life moment. You know what I mean?
No, it is.
And then when you have somebody, pardon my French, so badass, that's like running the St. Louis chapter, the Missouri chapter, whatever, of American Red Cross, I'm like, yeah. So tell me about Teen Institute.
You bet.
When you were a teenager.
So, I mean, what I can
tell you. Or your involvement with NCADA at that time.
You bet.
Like,
okay. I mean, I began, so NCADA's programming that you all still have is High Step, right?
Yes.
High School Taught Education Program, if memory serves me correctly.
Yes, that is correct.
And I began my freshman year of high school in High Step as one of the High Step presenters. We had a large High Step program at
What high school did you go to?
Crystal City High School.
Okay.
In Jefferson County.
Shout out Jefferson County.
Booming metropolis. I graduated with 57 people in my graduating class back in the in the 90s,
Got
early
it.
90s.
Mm-hmm.
But no, large High Step program. And
High Step is where high schoolers get trained to go in and deliver education lessons, stories, character ed kind of stuff to younger kids.
Exactly. And I loved it. I was the child of two teachers. Both my parents were
so
teachers.
Teaching was in the blood.
So teaching was in the blood. It's something that I grew up watching both of my parents teach and just thought, okay, I can do this. And I'd taught Sunday school. This was a perfect fit for me, and a perfect fit especially as a kid who was a high achiever academically and in music, but I wasn't in sports and I wasn't the most popular kid, right? I didn't quite fit in to that popular mold in a small high school.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, High Step was the place that not only did I fit in, but I thrived because I was able to use the gifts that I had in presenting and relating with kids and adults and others, telling stories, really in being comfortable in doing so. And then in leading by my senior year was the lead of our High Step program with our school counselor. And for me, it was something that gave me the self-esteem and the security that, you know what, I'm okay. Even I might not fit in here, but I do have gifts and skills to be used.
And by that point, I can imagine you developed a strong network of peers who were probably very similar to yourself, who maybe weren't, you know, quarterback or, you know, cheerleader, weren't popular, but also weren't like a social outcast. Mm-hmm. But it's also that, like, that middle area.
It really was.
And the middle area, especially for a teenager, but let's be real, even for adults, like that middle area can be very hard. So mm-hmm. the idea is to be mentors and have these young people look up to you mm-hmm. and see that it's cool and see that, you know, that they don't have to be getting wasted all the time to be, you know, cool and build relationships. So you're building the relationships with the young people, but then you're also building a cohort at your high school, of people who get you and see you.
And for me, and in such a small school, our High Step program truly was a pretty good cross-section of our school population.
So, which is how it's supposed to be.
So there were cheerleaders, there were quarterbacks, there were sports stars and music nerds and nerds like people like myself and others. We all, that was where we came together.
Yes.
And it was one of those places that was okay.
And you might not be sitting together in the lunchroom, but in this place, there was a real cross-section of kids from different, I would imagine, socioeconomic, you know, different beliefs and home and whatever. But like in there, that's the thing that bonded you.
That was exactly it.
I mean, and that is a protective factor. These are the things we talk about all the time.
Oh, no, very much so. It was. It was bringing us together, you know, as we were learning the curriculum, as we were really kind of learning those teaching tools, and then teaching in small groups, going through not only our elementary schools, but at the time, Jefferson R7 School District did not have a high school. So Crystal City High School, High Step, went into the R7 schools, and so all of their elementary schools as well. So it was learning to not only the teaching and the presentation skills, teaching and working with teachers, and just navigating that. A side of me that I didn't realize was there came out. And so it was through that Teen Institute came about my junior into my senior year that summer. Our school counselor brought it to me as we'd like to recommend you to go and to be a part. And so I did. I think that year, I think we were in somewhere in Jeff City, somewhere in mid-Missouri. There was a camp.
At that point in time, it was called like an MTI or an RTI, where it was more regional, or at one point we did them across the state.
Okay.
But we also then kind of did regional ones where kids, so basically with TI, you take your experience of what you had at High Step, and then you take that on a broader scale. And it's also a heterogeneous group of kids, right?
When
you're just
like
meeting people that you never, I mean, from towns that you never knew existed and who shared similar interests and were like not total social outcasts.
Right. For me as a small town girl, right? Growing up in a very small town, I was incredibly nervous. I remember before going because it was going to be the largest group of peers, of people of my own age that I'd ever really been with. A great preparation for college, I might add.
Oh, for sure.
But also, you know,
looks
within...
Looks great on a college resume.
And my parents might have said that
because I
might have been
the
dork, right, preparing that resume early, but nonetheless. But what I learned when I stepped in were they were students just like myself.
Yeah.
And even though we came, some of us from very small schools around Missouri, some of us came from large suburban schools, urban areas, we had something that brought us together. And it was that niche and that passion for, you know, preventative education, for really talking about some of those stigma topics that we didn't talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, right, it was the 80s, early 90s. It was very much alcohol and drug abuse centered, but more than that as well, talking about things like peer pressure, really looking at mental health in those components as well. And I remember that week feeling that I fit in in a capacity that I didn't think I did in my everyday world.
When I was in high school, so Leah Preston, does that name ring a bell?
Oh,
so
my gosh.
She was one
Maybe?
Of the, okay, so I know like Marilyn Bader and
yes.
those, okay.
Yeah.
So I went to Koryezu.
Okay.
Leah Preston was the counselor at Koryezu. I did not know this at the time and only found out about it when I started working here. She was a volunteer at Teen Institute.
Okay.
Because for years it was really volunteer led because we didn't have the staff, right? And looking back, I found out that some kids from the trend group went to Teen Institute. I was not in trend. I wish I would have been in retrospect because I had friends that were choosing to drink and smoke marijuana and like I didn't want to do that, but I didn't know how to navigate those. So instead I just went on a big soapbox and completely was that kid. And I was looking back on it, I'm like, oh my God, I was so judgmental. And I lost a ton of friends, right? And I wish I would have been in trend, but I wasn't. And so I didn't know really about TI when I was in high school. And then when I'm at NCADA and it's my, you know, I'm in the job interview and they're like, okay, well, part of this job is you're going to have to staff this 3-night, 4-day camp with a bunch of teenagers. And I'm like, I'm going to have to go to a drug camp? Like, what is this? And I thought my first year going in that it was going to be a bunch of dorks who, not that I'm cool, by the way, but I thought it was going to be like a bunch of dorks sitting around talking about like why it's bad to use drugs. And I was like, this is going to be terrible. And I am not supposed to choose favorites, but it is my most favorite program that we do. And you can truly see transformation from day one to day four.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the connection that teens have with each other, the self-growth, the connection that many of them have with adults for the first time ever.
Yes.
It is a life-changing experience, and I've never actually been a participant. I've only facilitated.
Yeah.
So I can't even imagine what it would be like to be a participant, especially at the height of it, I would say, when you had Harriet and when you had Marilyn and you had all these powerhouses. Like, I envy your experience.
Yeah, this would have been the summer of 1993, to put that in a little bit of context.
Yep.
And it really was. It was large and it was powerful. It was moving. It was at an era, right, as we look historically, the war on drugs, Nancy Reagan and all of that. It put context and construct to something that had been talked about on the news and in the media and in my classroom in a way that that I could understand. And that was more holistic than what I was getting in any other fashion. And really helped prepare me, not to sound too trite, but for that senior year and then going into college.
I hear you.
Because, right, I was in a small school, small town. I was not quite as soapboxy, it sounds like, as you might have been. But I could get on my soapbox. Okay, I can still get on my soapbox. Just ask my team. But, you know, every now and then. But to help me navigate that in college with peers in a larger school and a larger organization, it gave me the self-confidence and helped me know that I wasn't alone. Hmm. And that it really, it was a leadership component for me that was very influential to what I then, you know, kind of came into. I was an education major. So I started college. I was a music education major. And in my first career, I was a band director, music teacher.
Get out.
Fun fact you probably didn't know.
I did not know that.
Yes. So that music nerd, band dork that I was talking about, I became a junior high school band director, elementary music teacher, and taught for about 8 years.
Cool how the things that we beat ourselves up about, if we're doing it right, are the things that we kind of like hold on to and like wear with a badge of honor. You know,
very much so.
Yeah.
I as I've gotten older and at the time I was not confident enough to say this is who I am and these are my strengths and these are not my strengths and, you know, like it or leave it. I wasn't there then as a teenager.
Yeah.
I know teenagers now that are and thanks honestly in part to what you all do, but to what everyone does to build that self-confidence, that didn't happen in the 80s and early 90s. No one was self-aware and really had the ability to stand up for themselves and say, this is who I am, this is who I'm not. But in retrospect, to look back at me, at that, you know, 17-year-old Beth going through TI, and to recognize, no, the core of who she was is who I still am.
That's right.
You know?
Yes. I just got chills. Sorry. So speaking of the core of who we are, so my sister and I were talking last night on the phone. I have two nieces who are I see a lot of myself in them, in that they really want to do well in school. They don't like group projects. They'd rather do things on their own, and they go above and beyond on the projects because
I can resonate with that.
I know.
Deep
and
personal
like
level.
Spirits. Yeah. Okay. So I'm talking to my sister and nieces last night, and we're talking about something that I'm exploring. And my sister goes, you know, you need to go full on Clara Barton. And my niece
I
is
love
like,
it.
What? So my sister tells this story to my nieces about this project I did in eighth grade about a historical figure. I chose Clara Barton. And I went a little above and beyond.
Good
and
for you.
I rather than do an actual presentation, I decided to record a narrative pretending that I was Clara Barton and tending to these wounded soldiers in the field.
Oh.
And it was at the time that the Civil War documentary came out.
Yeah.
So I had, my dad had the soundtrack and I was like playing it in the background and I was like reenacting Clara Barton. And this was my school project.
I love it.
And I got an A.
Nicely done. Good job.
Okay.
Good job.
So then in high school, fast forward a couple of years, we have a social justice class. And in that social justice class, time for another project. I'm doing it on my own, and I pay homage to Elizabeth Dole and talk about the HIV crisis and blood banks and how they evolved and how all the things. And
wow.
Thank
impressive.
You.
Impressive.
So then fast forward, and then my first like real job after I taught, because that was really hard. I don't even know.
Same. I managed eight years.
Yep. I went into public health. And the thing that really like got me stoked was all of the disaster preparedness stuff. So I was in charge of the avian flu grants before COVID.
Yeah.
And all of the like hot washing and all of that kind of stuff. So I am like kind of an American Red Cross super fan.
I love it.
And I really want to be the people who, when there's a natural disaster, you like put up the bat signal and I go sandbag. Because, you know, growing up, the flood of 93, like
that was my first encounter with the Red Cross was in the floods of 93.
Yeah. Like, how did you get involved in this? Because like, I think this is so, I think your job, I know it's really hard. I think your organization is so vital and helps people in times of distress, but you also believe in prevention. That's
correct.
Why you do so much with blood donations and emergency preparedness to get prepared.
Yes.
Right? Like, I just think American Red Cross is so friggin' cool. How did you like make the leap from band director to that? Like, help me. I'm
there's a little incongruency there.
Yeah,
right.
But I'm like so interested in this.
Well, for me, it actually was all through our disaster response team. So obviously, going back in time, right? The flood of 93 was my senior year.
It hit Crystal City's on the river.
We went underwater.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I was the drum major that year, and our football field, you couldn't see the goalposts. Our field was under that much water.
Whoa.
My grandmother's home was flooded. Most of our homes in our community were flooded. It was a pretty intense year. They pulled us out of school to sandbag. The Red Cross
like
were...
Kim's Wick was like done.
Correct.
Like I grew up in Jeffco. So
good job. So no, Crystal was, there was one road in and out because we were right on the river, and so much of our downtown business district, so many homes were flooded. It made an impact on me.
How could it not have?
It made a substantial impact on me, even as a high school senior, right? And then, you know, fast forward many years, I had always been involved in my church growing up, obviously in music and in music in churches and so on. In the United Methodist Church, the United Methodist Church has something called UMCOR, United Methodist Committee on Relief. That is international and local disaster response. So not only involved in crises perhaps in Mozambique and Southeast Africa, but also in flood and cleanup kits and more locally. Mm-hmm. And had always been a part of that. When I left teaching, when I left music education behind, I actually went to seminary. And so that's my path through. I went to Garrett Seminary in Chicago on the campus of Northwestern, United Methodist Seminary, ordained clergy. I still am. And I served on the staff of large United Methodist churches in missions ministries, which always encompassed disaster response.
Oh, my God.
As a piece of all of that.
This is so exciting to me.
So I was serving in a large church here in St. Louis. I was on the staff, the clergy staff at Manchester United Methodist.
Which is a big one,
which
right?
is a very large church. Yeah, right at Manchester Road in 141.
Yep.
And was there during several large floods. And my first experience one night was getting a call from the Red Cross saying, we need to use your church as a shelter and we need to use it in about an hour. And so my husband, myself, and a few staff members met, and we cleaned out our gymnasium at the same time the city of Valley Park was being evacuated.
Well, I was just going to say, before they did the construction, that part of 141 is like, yep. I mean, it was underwater when it rained.
And the city at that time, the residential area, the flood wall was only so high, or the levee
right.
was only so high, and the water had risen to a point that we couldn't guarantee that the levee was not going to break with that much water pressure against it. So they evacuated the city of Valley Park, and they brought them, instead of remaining in Valley Park, where it is all in a basin,
yes.
even the churches and schools and so on there, they brought them up the hill to Manchester. And I was meeting Metro buses standing outside of the church as the Red Cross was pulling in with their big trailer with cots and blankets and food and stuff. And I saw the Red Cross in action.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw what I loved and appreciated of the organization was not just the response and how they handled it, but who they served and how they served. One of the, you know, the Red Cross movement is built upon seven fundamental principles. You probably know some of this as a Red Cross history nerd.
I like how you called me out on that. My sister, when she listens to this,
yes.
is going to be dying laughing. My knowledge of Clara
yes.
Barton is coming. But tell for people who don't know.
Correct. The seven fundamental principles, it's a component of the International Red Cross Red Crescent movement, which means that every national society of the Red Cross or Red Crescent adheres to these seven fundamental principles. The American Red Cross is one of the national societies, just like the Canadian Red Cross, the
yep.
Mexican Red Cross, right? The Ukrainian Red Cross, and more. There's a Red Cross Society or a Red Crescent Society in almost every country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
The fundamental principles that we adhere to, one of those is neutrality, which means that we serve anyone and everyone, regardless of who they are, who they love, where they live, or more, right? Period. And I watched mm-hmm. as the Red Cross was able to be what many times the church struggles with being. And it is that truly inclusive environment where everyone is welcomed and served regardless of who they are, mm-hmm. where they live, and more. And at a time that I was discerning my call really to ministry and to serve others, and I saw this wonderful ability of the American Red Cross, of a secular organization. It is not faith-based. It has no government funding and no faith connection. I saw them truly being the community, serving mostly as volunteers.
Largely volunteer.
We are 90% volunteer led. So to give you a picture, in the St. Louis metro area, which are the 19 counties that our group covers on both sides of the river, Illinois and Missouri, I have about 1,200 volunteers. And these are the people who are on the front lines of the Red Cross. If you've seen the Red Cross, you've probably seen a volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
You've not seen an employee. There's not many of us. They're volunteers. And the first volunteer I met, his name is Jerry Lambding. And Jerry was the one that showed up with that shelter trailer that night. And Jerry and a team of volunteers were with me in that shelter throughout the course of the next couple of weeks. And I got to know them and I got to learn more about the Red Cross. I started talking with my predecessor, with Cindy Erickson, and
mm-hmm.
started learning more about the organization and really saw their ability to not just serve the community, but also be a convener of other groups within the community in disaster response and disaster preparedness. Our church served as the MARC, Multi-Agency Resource Center. It's a group of governmental and non-governmental agencies that come together following a large disaster. It's convened by the Red Cross, and in this case, it was held in my church. And I saw the Red Cross convening all of these organizations working across government lines, across faith lines. I saw everything from the Salvation Army to several other denominational entities, Southern Baptists, just so many churches, faith-based governmental groups, all in one place at one time, all with a singular focus and a singular mission on helping the community. And it was at that time that I realized that's what I want to be a part of, mm-hmm. an organization that is able to bring diverse groups of people together in order to prevent and alleviate human suffering in the face of emergencies. That's the mission of the Red Cross.
Say that one more time.
The mission of the Red Cross is to prevent and alleviate human suffering in the face of emergencies by leveraging the power of volunteers and the generosity of donors. And that's what I wanted to be a part of. And it was shortly thereafter. My background's always been in nonprofit management. So from my background in music education, in the church, always serving in large churches and working internationally with UMCOR and nationally with UMCOR, it was a natural progression into the Red Cross. My first career in the Red Cross was as the regional information and planning manager. So I covered the 199 counties in Missouri, Arkansas, Illinois, and Kansas that we covered. And I did all of the emergency plan, multi-jurisdiction plan, statewide plan. So all of the scary things that folks don't, you don't want to know about nuclear power plants and what happens. You don't want to know about, you know, the New Madrid fault, when it happens, if people are liquefied or not, right? All of those large plans, working across multi-jurisdictional plans, data visualization, data analysis, all of those pieces for a broad regional team. And it was from there that then the executive director position came open, and I put my name in the hat, applied, and was blessed to be able to be here today. So 3 years later now, a little over 3 years.
I think you're a rock star. And one, when I see you, we were talking before we started recording about how usually when you're on something like this, it's like when there's a disaster, right? And quite frankly, when you need to be doing 15 other things besides sitting there telling people like, what we really could use is donations. Like, please don't bring, you know, your old jeans with holes in them. Like, please don't do that. Like, please give us donations so that we can help them in the ways that we know that they need help. But how do you remain so calm? I mean, that is a real, that is a real question, because you're leading a team. You're leading 1,200 volunteers. You're leading the general public who wants to know how to help but doesn't exactly know how to help but feels compelled to help. You don't want them to necessarily like come start sandbagging, because then you're dealing with a people management issue. But sometimes you just need people to get here and help sandbag. And you're dealing with media, and you're dealing with your own personal life, because, you know, for example, during COVID, like, you're trying to manage that, but you also have your own health and your family's health that you're thinking about. So, like, how do you stay calm, especially in the face of disaster or emergency?
To be a non-anxious presence is my goal. To be able to be, you know, the axiom of a duck, right? Calm on the surface and paddling like hell underneath, right? That's a mantra. Some of it is I can, and my husband has caught this in me, I can assume almost a different pitch of my voice, right? My husband's like, okay, I need you to turn off work and just be. But there is the ability to flip almost a switch, to be able to be calm, to see strategically what needs to happen, and to lean on an amazing team to be able to make that happen. I learned that, honestly, early on, bluntly, through High Step, because
I did not pay you to say that.
No, she did not pay me to say that. But so, I mean, those are my first experiences. And I was going up, I think one of the most frightening experiences that I can remember is going up in front of a group of first graders. They're squirrely.
I'd rather go to middle schoolers than like lower elementary.
Graders. And my mother, who is a fifth grade teacher, said, never let them see you sweat. Don't let them see your fear. If they see it, you're dead. And I learned early on from my mother and my father, both teachers, that when I walk in that door, I was to walk in. My dad used to tell me, walk like I was a large bird with tentacles on my feet, and just that I grasped the floor in which I stood and that I would not be moved. And I learned early on, both as a musician, right, standing in front of people and performing, and as an educator, the need to be able to be that non-anxious presence, to be able to get a message across to people. Now, I will kid you not, my team, especially, you know, my disaster team, there have been moments that I am not that presence. When it all breaks loose and you can't be. It's also okay to be real.
I was going to say, like, your team, I've learned, I mean, it's been a hard lesson, but I've learned that my team also needs to see vulnerability in me. They need to see that I'm a human being, that I struggle, that I care too.
Exactly.
You know, because if we're just an impenetrable force, like, that's nobody wants to be around somebody like that.
And it's also not healthy mental health-wise either, because then compartmentalizing, right? Then you compartmentalize, and where does that line stop? When do you allow those emotions to actually be able and flow? You can only compartmentalize so much.
Yeah.
And fortunately, you know, in press conferences, in interviews, at those times, you're able to do that. But in front of a team, to be able to take that energy, to tell them that it's okay to be worried, to be scared, to be stressed to the gills. Because during a large disaster response, what most of the public don't know is that our team, again, mostly volunteer-led with a handful of staff, usually average a 14-hour day, 14 mm-hmm. to 16-hour day every single day. So you're physically exhausted. You're emotionally exhausted because you're seeing and working with individuals who have just lost everything. You're trying to corral different nonprofits and governmental agencies and work collaboratively across. It's taxing mentally, emotionally, and physically. It's okay to show that behind closed doors with your team, to have a place to acknowledge it and then to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
To take that, to acknowledge what is, but then look at why you're there, what you're doing, and how you're able to clearly communicate and strategically move forward to see that big picture and to see what needs to happen and then make it happen.
Hmm.
And that is something that perhaps it's because of my musician background, to be able to see a full score of a sheet of music and then be able to pull out one melody or one nuanced crescendo.
Whoa.
Within that large picture is something that is relatively, I won't say easy, but it's something that I can do.
Yeah, it seems like it's a skill
prioritize.
Of yours.
It is. And it's a piece that's also been developed through classes in emergency management, through leadership lessons, through courses in nonprofit management, right, and more. But it is the ability to be a non-anxious presence in leadership, but also to be vulnerable at the same time.
Hmm.
Not that it's easy.
No, it's not easy, but I'm just letting it sink in,
mm-hmm.
kind of what you're saying. And I think what you're verbalizing is what I try to do, but that non-anxious presence is something that I know that I need to continue to work on, because I know when I'm having a really good day, like, people feel it. And when I'm like, not like, I know people feel it too, and not because I go around going, I'm having a bad day, but
right.
I just know how my mood is.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the privileges of being a leader of an organization,
mm-hmm.
is that you do get to lead and coach and bring people along, but also, like, you have to be very mindful,
yes.
of how you're setting the tone. And it can be a beautiful thing, and it also can be like a...
Very much so.
Uh-huh.
I learned early on, some of my first deployments, when I was on our disaster team, I would deploy nationally to large hurricanes, large responses across the nation. And I was many times on a leadership team that was brought in before the hurricane made impact to organize, to set up systems and structures,
yep.
and make sure that we knew what was going on where. And I remember being in... South Carolina during Hurricane Florence, as it was making impact, as the hurricane was making impact, our leadership team was gathered in a ballroom in a hotel, and I was on my computer. We were having to relocate some of our shelters because they were flooding. And I had my computer open, and we were mapping and doing some flooding work, trying to figure out where we should move people. And the fire alarm goes off in the building.
Mm.
And it's pouring buckets outside, raining sideways. The fire department makes us evacuate. And I have my phone on my ear. I have a volunteer holding my laptop as I'm trying to relocate a few hundred people who are being flooded out of their shelter while standing in the rain with another person holding an umbrella over the top of me. And for me, that was one of my most stressful moments of, I don't know what to do.
Yeah, right.
But... to take that breath, to channel through it, to keep the main thing, and to work each piece, chewable chunks, as it goes through. So the most important thing at that point was relocating the individuals. Everybody else was out here in the rain with me. I had wonderful people that were holding my computer and an umbrella while we were relocating people, right? adrenaline can also do some pretty amazing things.
It is true. Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of amazing things, when we were sitting down, Max, I'm breaking the fourth wall here, but Max is on the Spring Awards Luncheon Committee as well. And we were having conversations about, you know, who we wanted to recognize. And we don't always have people in every category. And this year for our 50th, you know, we really wanted to lean into a lot of the categories, particularly the alumni leadership. And we were like, okay, well, who would be a good fit for this award? And then we would talk through it, and who would be a good fit for this award? And when the alumni leadership award came up, I was like, I got the person, because of everything you've just spent the last 10 minutes talking about is your presence, your calming presence in times of crisis, but also preparing people for those times of crisis. Mm-hmm. And in my estimation and in our team's estimation, like, you are, yes, you're an alum of our programs, but you're also a community leader and somebody who really, like, sets the tone and who I look to as somebody to help kind of center me and calm me. You've been on calls where I kind of get a little, I get a little worked up, right? And you're just always so calming, but in a very authentic way, not in a one note, like, who the hell is this lady, but like just in a, like, you got this.
Thank
like,
you.
And that is the best compliment I can give you, is that, like, you are a, like, a force, like a calming, steadfast force in our community and to me personally, and imagine to your team and to countless others. So I'm so grateful for you. I'm grateful that our community has you. I cannot speak more highly of you. So thank you.
Thank you. Truly, not only for the opportunity to come today, but for everything that you and the organization does, truly made an impact in my life, but makes an impact in the lives of countless others. Truly, it takes a village. You know, we're reminded St. Louis is one of the most philanthropic communities in the nation.
Yes.
We know, and we both say this a lot, but at the end of the day, it's each of us, each of our nonprofits, each of us working together that makes the community resilient, that makes the community who and what it is and who and what it can be, truly. We do it together.
Thank you so much. I cannot wait to see you again in a couple of months and stand and cheer you on as you get this award. Obviously, you don't do it for that, but every once in a while, it's kind of nice to be recognized, especially not in the midst of, like, a natural disaster. Mm. So, yeah. Thank you so much, Beth. If you like what you heard, please consider rating or subscribing or giving us a review, telling us how much you really enjoyed this conversation. Or maybe you're like me and you were a total Clara Barton nerd when you were younger. You never know. Nerds unite. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us at The Preventable, brought to you ad-free by PreventEd. PreventEd works to reduce or prevent the harms of alcohol and other drug use through education, intervention, and advocacy. Please visit their website at PreventEd.org. Like what you heard? Rate, review, and subscribe to stay up to date with what we are serving on The Preventable.